This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
People are tired of sitting on the back of a motorbike and having a bad helmet here, and it rains, and the buses are sometimes full, so the take-up is amazing.
That's Thomas Schaffer, CEO for Volkswagen in sub-Saharan Africa, on electric cars in Rwanda. Details coming up also. The political impasse in Malawi stemming from disputed May elections shows no signs of ending. And Abdel Fattah al-Sisi and Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed agreed to resume deadlocked technical negotiations on the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. The political impasse in Malawi stemming from disputed May elections shows no signs of ending. President Peter Mutharika has offered to negotiate with the opposition, but opposition parties say the president is illegitimate and should step aside. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Political tensions started rising in May when opposition leaders rejected election results that showed Peter Mutharika winning a second term. Since then, a civil rights group, the Human Rights Defenders Coalition, has led protests pushing for the resignation of Malawi Electoral Commission chairperson Jenny Ansah for allegedly mismanaging the polls. Ansah denies the accusation. Authorities say the protests, vandalism and violence have affected the country's development. Mark Bottoman is government spokesperson.
Our economy somehow has slowed down because even our revenue authority has for some months now has not been able to meet the targets in terms of collecting revenues because businesses have been affected. People's property has damaged. Government property has been destroyed.
Bottoman says the standoff is likely to make the country lose the foreign investment.
The situation that we are facing in this country is scaring away potential investors. This country needs investors. This country needs economic advancement, which we've already started building. It needs to be sustained. But with the political impasse happening in the country, we cannot see our economy continue growing.
Official results showed Mutharika winning the May election with 39% of the vote. Runners-up Lazarus Chakwera of the Malawi Congress Party and Saulos Chilima of the United Transformation Movement Party challenged the results in court, alleging ballot stuffing and the use of collection fluid to change votes. Efforts to end the political standoff have yielded nothing, and a recent call from Mutharika for negotiations with opposition leaders and civil rights organizations has been ignored. Ezinho Wankaka is the Secretary General of the opposition Malawi Congress Party.
Look here, we've been very clear, we've been very consistent. We look at Mr. Mutharika as an illegitimate president. And currently we are in court challenging his legitimacy. What sense does it carry for us to start talking about negotiation?
Analyst Humphrey Mvula says the impasse would end only if President Mutharika acts above party politics.
The ball goes back to the president. This whole problem is a problem about the president. And somehow he believes that this issue will walk away on its own or blow away. So he has got to take up the reins and say, look, I'm the president, can we talk? Where necessary, he should bring in people to help him mediate.
Government spokesperson Bottoman says officials are making efforts to bring all the concerned parties to the negotiating table. In the meantime, the Human Rights Defenders Coalition says it will continue holding protests until Ansah resigns from the Electoral Commission. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Facebook has removed entities tied to Yevgeny Prigozhin, a Russian businessman close to Vladimir Putin, for disinformation campaigns in Africa. Salem Salomon has the story.
After weeks-long investigation, Facebook is removing groups and Instagram accounts seeking to interfere with African political affairs, the company said Wednesday. The pages have been linked to Yevgeny Prigozhin, a Russian businessman with close ties to Vladimir Putin. The action follows a joint effort between Facebook and researchers at the Stanford Internet Observatory, a group focused on researching new technology. Shelby Grossman is a research scholar at the observatory and author of a report on Russia's online operations in Africa.
Entities linked to Yevgeny Prigozhin are engaged in social media activities in several African countries to a much wider extent than we've previously known. And we believe that this is consistent with Russian commercial-linked activities and to some extent with Russian state political interests as well.
Prigozhin, commonly called Putin's chef in Russian media, was indicted by special counsel Robert Mueller for taking part in criminal and espionage conspiracy in connection with the 2016 U.S. presidential election. The latest allegations involve online activity in Cameroon, the Central African Republic, Côte d'Ivoire, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Madagascar, and Mozambique. In some cases, Russia went as far as hiring local reporters to spread their message.
Prigozhin-linked entities are subcontracting out or hiring real local reporters and possibly a regional digital marketing firm as well. And I think this is important because it really increases the hurdles to attribution for these types of inauthentic information campaigns.
Facebook said Russia spent around $77,000 in advertising as part of the campaign. The first ad Facebook identified in the report ran in April 2018, and the most recent ad ran in October 2019. But the effort went beyond Facebook.
These Prigozhin-linked entities are not just using Facebook. They have created Telegram groups and WhatsApp groups, and they, in some cases, created Google Forms to try to engage more closely with citizens. One of the pages targeting Mozambique actually ran a contest. So I think those are some of the activities that we see that are new, in particular in Africa.
Grossman said the content and style of the pages vary widely by country. In general, they tended to support ruling political parties and deride democratic activities and opposition groups. For example, in Mozambique, sites supported Frelimo, the main political party in the country, in advance of elections. In Sudan, Facebook pages initially supported former dictator Omar al-Bashir and then switched to the transitional military council following his ouster. In Libya, the pages supported both rogue general Khalifa Haftar and his political rival Saif al-Islam.
These pages were interesting in part because many of them posted a lot of Muammar Gaddafi nostalgia content. So trying to get Libyans to think about the positive parts of living under Gaddafi's rule and then throwing in posts that were supportive of his son.
Grossman said, often the pages are linked to activity conducted by the Wagner Group, Prigozhin's military arm, which supplies contractors in several African countries. The Wagner Group is training and arming militaries in Libya, Mozambique, and the Central African Republic, among other places. Cameron Hudson is a senior fellow at the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. He said, without the ability to make large economic deals, Russia's main interest now is courting influence on the African continent and its military and intelligence capabilities. It is also willing to support regimes that the West will not.
Russia is willing to do business with a lot of unsavory actors. It's willing to do business with regimes that are seeking to hold on to power through unconstitutional methods. It's willing to do business with military governments, governments that Western democracies might not be so quick to embrace. Russia sees itself as having an advantage in going after those markets.
Hudson said Russia's aim is to make its presence felt in the same way it did during the Cold War, but with a much smaller investment.
Russia doesn't have the political clout, it doesn't have the ideological clout, and it certainly doesn't have the financial backing to play the role that it played during the Cold War, where it was a heavy investor in development projects in Africa, where ideologically it was bringing African leaders to study the communist model.
the country believes cyber interference in the affairs of other countries gives it the most bang for its buck, Hudson added.
So how does it have its influence felt? Well, it can do it through things like social media and online influence, which is a relatively low-cost way to have the impact on the world stage that they're looking to have. And anything that they can do to undermine the free press, democratic institutions, and to sow doubt in the minds of populations, I think, probably plays into their broader vision of aligning themselves with states and countries that are not democracy.
Salem Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
Following a recent meeting in Russia, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi and Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed agreed to resume deadlocked technical negotiations on the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. Meanwhile, the U.S. has offered a mediation headed by the U.S. Treasury Secretary on November 6th, aiming to reach a pact on conditions for operating the dam and a timetable for filling the reservoir behind it. Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about the latest efforts to avoid a conflict over water rights.
Well, I see this as a positive development. This dispute isn't a technical issue. It's a question about how quickly the dam should be filled in order that it doesn't affect the downstream availability of water for Egypt. And I think all sides have recognized that Egypt has very significant strategic interest in ensuring the access to the water. And really, so the question is, what's the best means for filling up that dam and agreeing on technical terms how best to do that?
But the work of the technical committee had failed to produce an agreement despite years of discussions between officials from Egypt, Ethiopia, and Sudan. What could make it succeed this time?
I think it should be recognized that the technical committee, by most accounts, was seen to be making progress prior to the Egyptians pulling out earlier this year and complaining that the talks were stalled. In fact, the sense was that they were dealing with very serious and complicated issues in a constructive, multilateral manner. And the process is important because identifying the correct rate of filling the dam will be important for ensuring that it doesn't affect the downstream flow. But it also creates an important factual foundation of understanding that if all sides agree and understand on the technical issues, then that provides the basis for resolving any subsequent policy issues that may result or emerge with regards to the dam. So I think this is all a very important step in creating a strong foundation for an ongoing means for managing the dam once it's completed.
The U.S. offered a mediation headed by Secretary of Treasury early November to reach a pact on conditions for operating the dam and the timetable for filling the reservoir behind it. Is that still valid after Ethiopia refused any mediation on the technical issues?
I think whether or not meetings take place is still an open question. Prime Minister Abiy, I believe, said that he's open to dialogue on a political level, and such talks could be useful for providing assurances among the political leaders involved. However, I think one needs to be cautious that we don't create two separate and parallel means of negotiation. There is already this existing technical committee where there have been very detailed discussions about what needs to take place. And so you don't want to undermine that from the political meeting. I think from the Ethiopian perspective, the advantage of having this sort of high-level discussion would just be to provide assurances to President Sisi and the Egyptians that their interests are being considered and that there will be confidence-building measures built into any agreement.
Earlier this month, Ethiopian Prime Minister warned that Ethiopia could deploy millions of people in the event of an armed conflict with Egypt. Would such scenario emerge if the technical negotiations failed again?
Prime Minister Abiy's when he said that, he also said, you know, war is not a solution. And I think he, and in previous occasions, President Sisi has also said that they are not seeking war. So this issue should not be one that leads to any sort of armed conflict. It's a technical issue that can't be resolved through ongoing negotiations. And I think, you know, these sorts of statements are really just posturing between the sides to show the high level of engagement that they have on the matter.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA Senior Analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Rising temperatures and talk of droughts and water shortages have left many people in southern Africa worried. Growing heat has affected already dry and drought-stricken areas, aggravating existing vulnerabilities and affecting water resources and agriculture. But experts say it is not time to panic yet. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
The effects of climate change have reached new heights in southern Africa. The region has experienced multiple heat waves since September. Weather experts also predict that serious rains won't arrive until December. South Africa is among the worried countries, though panic hasn't set in yet. Many municipalities have hinted at possible water shortages. Lindiwe Sisulu, the Minister of Water and Sanitation in South Africa, rang the alarm when he briefed the nation this week on the looming water crisis. In anticipation of drought that already has hit parts of Zimbabwe, the government in Harare has allowed its citizens to import maize and animal feeds from neighboring countries. Johan Malherbe, a meteorologist at the Pretoria-based Council for Scientific and Industrial Research, CSIR, says warming and the frequency of drought in the region is set to accelerate. Junette John, an environmental health scientist at CSIR, says climate change in the region will have a direct impact on human health. The experts are urging governments to have early warning systems in place so communities can take appropriate steps to cushion themselves from elements such as heat waves, drought, and floods. According to the United Nations Food Agency, a record 45 million people in southern Africa will be severely food insecure in 6 months' time. The International Panel on Climate Change has cautioned that temperatures in southern Africa are rising at twice the global average. The Democratic Republic of Congo, Malawi, Mozambique, Tanzania, Zambia, and Zimbabwe are leading the countries that will be worst affected. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
South Sudan's President Salva Kiir has declared a state of emergency in parts of the country affected by flash floods caused by months of torrential rains. Officials say more than 1 million people have been displaced. The Bahar el Ghazal and the Upper Nile regions have been the worst affected. Minister for Humanitarian Affairs and Disaster Preparedness, Hussein Maniot, says hundreds of farms have been destroyed. Maniot says he met with officials from several aid agencies to ask for financial support to aid flood victims, but was told their funding for this year is finished. Heavy rain is expected to continue for the next 6 weeks. Maniot warned of possible famine. Rwanda's government is getting behind the carbon neutral movement by promoting electric cars and motorcycles. German automaker Volkswagen is demonstrating electric vehicles in Kigali, while a local company has begun selling electric bikes. Will the vehicles work in a city with a dense population and poor road system? Ruud Elmendrop went to Kigali to seek answers.
We're on the parking lot of the Kigali International Convention Center. Rwandan Prime Minister Edouard Ngirente steps in a Volkswagen electric car and maneuvers it around with no problems, like it was his own. And this is the official launch of a pilot program by Volkswagen. The company is putting 4 electric cars on the road for Kigali residents to try out through the Uber-like Move service. And if all goes well, the automaker will roll out another 50 electric cars to be powered by 15 charging stations. Ngirente says electric cars will be a step forward in Rwanda's drive to become less dependent on carbon-emitting fossil fuels.
Rwandans are becoming increasingly aware that protecting the environment is a top priority.
Arrival of the e-cars follows the introduction of electric motorcycles in Rwanda. Because of a poor road system and dense population, 70% of Kigali residents rely on motorbikes to get around. Kigali-based Ampersand is one of the companies hoping to see the public switch to electric-powered bikes. They look cool with a classy design and are manufactured partly in India, partly in Rwanda. The cost, around $1,000. Ampersand CEO Josh Wolf says that these motorcycles fulfill a need.
The motorcycles are simply cheaper to acquire and cheaper to operate, but actually have more power and more performance than the current petrol motorcycles used.
The e-bikes use a battery that lasts for about 75 kilometers of driving. Despite the limitations, Emmanuel Dayambaza says he's happy. He says he loves the electric bike because it's good. It requires little maintenance, and he says he makes more money than with a fuel motorbike. Battery life is one of the challenges for Ampersand. They're working on increasing the capacity and having more than the current 2 charging stations. The Ministry of Infrastructure is monitoring the progress with the e-bikes. If found suitable, it will start promoting them, says Ministry official Alfred Biriangiro.
After the realizing that electric motorcycle can be used on our terrain, which is a hilly terrain, we just entice people on advantages of using electric bikes and electric motorcycles.
Ampersand hopes to have 500 e-bikes on the road next year. But they might feel competition from the electric cars, according to Volkswagen Sub-Saharan Africa CEO Thomas Schaefer.
People are tired of sitting on the back of a motorbike and having a bad helmet here, and it rains and the buses are sometimes full, so the take-up is amazing.
While for now motorcycles remain king of the road in Rwanda, e-cars and e-bikes are gaining ground and may lead the country to an electric, carbon-neutral future. Ruth Almendorp for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our engineer, Shogun Chung, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, sports fans. This is the voice of America's Sonny Young. Please join me Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC for the sunny side of sports. On Fridays, you can also hear my expanded 30-minute edition of the show at 17:30 UTC, right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, conflict in Cameroon between the government and the English-speaking regions has caused death and displacement of 500,000 people. We'll explore how a peaceful resolution can be achieved on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA.